Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Alex Sears and my guest for this session is the director Ned Bennett, whose powerful production of Philip Ridley's outstanding 2005 play Mercury Fur is currently on at the Old Red Lion Fringe venue in London in a co-production with the Greenhouse Theatre Company. Ned trained on the Lambda postgraduate directing course and, in addition to numerous other credits, was apprentice director to Sean Mathias on Breakfast at Tiffany's at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Ned.
Thank you.
Could you start by telling us how you got involved with this play?
Yes. Joel Samuels and Henry Lewis, who founded Greenhouse Theatre Company, they were at Lambda at the same time as me. Oh. So we had sort of trained together, and they had set up the company just as they left drama school about a year ago. And they'd looked at various texts, and they had a strong conviction that they weren't going to be led by a particular agenda, but more by something that they saw as a great idea or a great story. So they were looking at Priestley, and they were looking at Ridley. And they were keen to do Mercury Fur. So they approached me about the play, and I jumped for the opportunity.
Yeah, because you're interested in new writing in general, aren't you?
Yeah. I tend to go towards new writing, and have been working with a couple of writers for the last couple of years. So the prospect of doing a contemporary piece was definitely something I was keen to do.
Yeah, because although this is technically a revival and not the first either, it is still very much a sort of contemporary play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
Could you give a sort of plot summary of Mercury Fur then?
Yeah, Mercury Fur, it's set in an almost post-apocalyptic East End of London. And it's about a group of young lads in their sort of teens and early 20s who, in order to survive, they set up parties for people in order to enact their wildest fantasies.
And they're for people who are rich enough to pay to enact.
Yeah.
The kind of fantasies that are usually gross and violent.
Absolutely. Parties that have a high cost on them.
Yeah.
And so they sort of, on the black market, they set up these parties. And the story is about them setting up a particular party for a man who works in the city.
And the two main characters there, Elliot and Darren, and their brothers, their employer, his name is Spinks.
Yes.
Yeah, and they also meet other characters throughout the play.
Yeah.
So there's a local boy called Naz, is that right? And then they also meet the Duchess and Lola. Can you just fill us in about those other characters?
Yeah, sure. So the Elliot and Darren's relationship with Spinks and Lola goes way back, because Spinks and Lola are brothers. And Elliot is in a relationship with Lola. And was rescued from hospital by Spinks during some of the worst moments in the riots that formed the backdrop of the piece. And without giving too much away about the plot, they also have strong links with the Duchess, who is cared for and in a relationship with Spinks.
Yeah, she's an older woman, she's blind. Yeah.
And she's been affected by events that have happened during the course of the riots.
Yeah, let's talk a little about those riots, as you said, the backdrop of the story. So can you just tell a bit of that story? Because, of course, Philip Ridley quite often tells these apocalyptic or very vivid tales of what has happened.
Yeah, the story is set at a time of political and civil unrest, and we're given clues throughout the story as to what's happened and what's caused this. What we're told is that that butterflies have been released among the people, the character of Elliot, he has his own theories as to where these butterflies have come from, but these butterflies have a narcotic effect on the people that eat them, which has caused which is one of the main causes of society in this world completely breaking down, shops being looted, buildings being torched, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and hospitals invaded and looting and everything like that. Yeah. Can you talk a bit more about the relationship between Elliot and Darren? I mean, they're brothers, but they're quite different characters, aren't they?
Yeah, Elliot's the older of the two brothers, and he's very thoughtful and introspective. Mm. And he makes a point of saying that he's almost, bar on one occasion, he's not taken any of the butterflies.
Yeah.
And so he's much more compos mentis, and his memory has been it hasn't been affected as it would have been had he been taking the butterflies.
Mm.
Whereas his younger brother Darren has been taking the butterflies, and to a certain extent, for various other reasons, he's got brain damage.
Yeah.
And so they have this kind of almost George and Lenny relationship. Where they need each other on an emotional and physical level.
Mm.
Given the line of work they do, Darren is sort of the muscle in the relationship and Elliot's the brains.
Mm.
There's a strong bond of love between them.
Mm.
Despite the fact that Elliot describes him as being an anvil round his neck.
Yeah,
and talks about him holding him back and holding him down.
That's right, yes, I remember that, yeah.
But it's clear from the text that they not only love each other but they greatly respect each other, despite some of the abusive language they use about each other and almost a physical violence between them as well.
Returning to the whole story of the butterflies, I mean, and you've alluded to this by talking about Darren as well. They're not only drugs and symbolise that kind of mass distribution of drugs amongst the population. They're also a metaphor for the loss of historical memory.
Mm.
I think that's clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that affects in particular Darren. I think he has a fantastic speech where he talks about this assassination of Kennedy and what does he bring into it? All sorts of other things.
And he makes connections with Marilyn Monroe. He makes up a relationship that she might have had with Hitler. Any sense of history, sense of actual history has completely gone out the window.
Yeah.
Whereas Elliot, when he was younger, actually wanted to be an archaeologist.
Yeah.
And has a strong interest in history and takes an understanding of where mankind has come from very seriously.
Mm.
So you've got this massive juxtaposition of someone whose brain who is so addled that he completely mixes up what's happened in the world with someone who takes a lot of care to pass on the detail of what has actually happened.
Yeah, that's right.
But where a sense of history is being lost because the younger generation are on a feeding frenzy on these butterflies.
Mm. Yeah, so Elliot's actually rescued items from the sacked British Museum.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is great now because great. I mean, it's one of those awful things that it's a kind of echo of the sacking of the Baghdad Museums, of course.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
But also talking of historical memory, there is that marvelous bit, isn't it, where Elliot talks about the pharaohs and how they had to kill the slaves that they used, and obviously he means that meeting this local boy Naz will be bad for Naz because they'll have to kill him if he witnesses this party. But of course, this is all lost on Darren.
Yeah.
You know,
who probably doesn't quite understand what he's saying despite what he says, and so goes along with it, which you know, could have potentially damaging repercussions.
And how do you see his relationship with Naz, Darren and Naz? Because they sort of hit it off quite rapidly, don't they?
Yeah, Philip Ridley had spoken to us about how they, because of the extent of which society had been fractured, it's possible that the two young lads who are sort of 15, 16, it's possible that they might not have met other boys their own age, or not for a while.
Mm.
And this is something we sort of explored in their relationship, but that they both have a kind of naive innocence about them that lends themselves to be very trusting and open.
Mm.
And so although he's been given strict instructions by Elliot and by Spinks to sort of trust no one and to not bring any strangers into the group, they hit it off straight away and they become quite close friends quite quickly.
Yeah. And in fact your actors bring that across very well, that kind of naivety as well, but that instant sort of attraction. Let's move on to an older figure, the party guest.
Yeah.
Somebody who works in the city, maybe a banker, maybe a broker, it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter. Can you talk a bit about him?
Yeah, with various possibilities we explored with his character, the idea that he, in terms of his own fantasies, he's possibly done as much as he's allowed to do legally, and sees given the current climate of the country, he sees it as a chance now to enact something that's morally abhorrent and violent, and he sees this as a chance now to do this.
And he's willing to pay a lot of money.
And he sees it as the last thing he as the only thing he needs to do.
You obviously think that the general world of the play reflects society, and perhaps even more closely now after the riots of last year than it did originally. Is that right?
Yeah, when Greenhouse first chose to do the play, that wasn't their main agenda, but it was something we weren't going to ignore.
Yeah.
And especially seeing as some of the responses to the original production were reactionary in terms of the direction in which a city might go in if it were something as bad as this to happen.
Yeah.
Joel Samuels, the artistic director of the company, talks about, you know, Mercury Fair as possible an example of what might have happened had the London riots gone on day by day, month by month.
Also, there are some standout lines, aren't there? For example, I'm thinking of the party guest when he says, "We're all in it together." I mean, you know, almost miraculous as an echo of David Cameron and that whole conservative thing. And obviously, when you noticed that, you must have been delighted.
Yeah, I mean, it's this idea that these young guys are, in some ways, they're trying to make themselves completely unaccountable for what's going on.
Mm.
But they are joining in, and they're facilitating the party guests' deepest, darkest needs. Mm. They arguably, without giving too much away, they go on their own kind of moral arc through the course of the story.
Yeah, that's right. And also, there were several moments when they do talk about riots and the past where it seemed less of a sort of dystopia or future vision than actually a highly metaphorical account of what's happening at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's some of the greatness in the text, that it goes off on the one hand, it alludes to events that seem possibly unlikely in our society but have actually happened and happened around the world almost verbatim, but takes it off into this imaginary, unique and original world, as is typical of Ridley's writing.
Yeah, and in fact also typical is this idea of storytelling, isn't it? Mm. The way that storytelling is used to calm down conflicts between the brothers, or that kind of evocative chanting that they do. Is that right?
It seems like they, on a very almost primal level, they use storytelling to get through the hardships that they're coming up against, and they use storytelling to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that through using these stories, they manage to communicate with each other and form a society on a profound level, considering their, for a lot of them, their cognitive abilities have been so far affected by corroded, the butterflies. Yeah. They've been corroded, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And some of the stories they tell, the Naz story, for example, is particularly horrific. But in a way, although this has offended some critics, surely horrible things do happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite a sort of reasonable account of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a horrifying story, but it equally we had been mistaken to not represent things on stage that actually happen in the world.
Yeah. Your production, and can you talk a bit about the set and its design? I think you've got a designer, James Turner, who you worked with.
Yeah, James Turner had... he wanted to sort of express the corrosive nature of society and what we had, and put that on stage. Mm. And he'd looked in, he'd researched into derelict blocks of flats and derelict houses, and worked. We'd sort of looked at the idea of creating a texture that exemplifies what's going on.
Yeah, it's really dusty.
Yeah. It's very dusty. Yeah.
So the whole play takes place in real time,
yeah,
in this kind of derelict squat, more or less. Mm-hmm. I just wondered why you included an interval, because I remember seeing previous productions where it runs straight through very effectively.
Unfortunately, the interval was for practical reasons. We were worried that up in the theatre, it's a brilliant space, but it gets very, very hot.
It does, yeah.
And so we you know, whilst it is 2 hours of real time,
yeah,
and it's definitely best kept that way, we had to accommodate the audience for that.
Yeah,
and let them get a breath of fresh air.
I must admit, when I saw it last night, I did welcome that breath of fresh air halfway through. Could you talk a bit about your audiences? Because last night was sold out. Tonight, I believe, is sold out. You've had a fantastic response, although you didn't have many reviews in the newspapers. You were reviewed quite a lot on the internet. I mean, is there something generational happening here, do you think?
I think there is, and it feels like our main ally in getting the word out there has been Twitter, and people talking about the play. It's nice to be able to, the curtain comes down and quite literally 10 minutes later you can see the audience's response on Twitter.
It
sort of seems to be getting the word out there to the extent whereby a blog review might go on Twitter, and then a review from a newspaper might see that and be interested in coming down.
And so it's
audiences have picked up in the last couple of weeks.
Oh, that's interesting. And I was also struck by how young most of the audience were. They seemed sort of early 20s. Is that right? Is that your impression or not?
It's been predominantly a younger audience, but there has been equally a kind of a strong proportion of sort of early 30s, late 30s audience, and so probably the generation that have been following Ridley's work all the way through from the Pitchfork Disney.
That's right, which in fact recently has been revived, and his new one as well has been out. What kind of audience responses have you had, you know, explicitly? Have people said anything to you, or have you picked up various things?
We've had lots of different reactions. The predominant thing has been people who felt like they felt a kind of physical, visceral reaction to what's been going on.
Yeah.
And that's been fantastic. But then on the flip side of that, some people have been made to feel uncomfortable and not enjoyed the experience of going through that. It's interesting how it's had different reactions in that respect.
Yeah.
And then some nights had people screaming in the audience. But then speaking to them afterwards, they actually enjoyed the experience.
So. Yeah. Well, it all sort of suddenly accelerates in the last few minutes, doesn't it? And it is quite horrific. It literally, you know, something explodes onto the stage. And you're hoping to sort of that this show will have an afterlife, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that if the company can sort of raise the funds, we hope to put it on again at some point soon. Yeah.
Right. And what about your next project after this one?
Next project is it's a bit of a departure from new writing. I'm collaborating with another director, Edward Stambouloulian. And we're going to be devising a short play, which we hope to put on in the next couple of years.
Great, fantastic. Yeah. Great, thank you very much, Ned.
Thanks, Alex. Thank you.